This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Hello, everybody. It's too early to yawn. I haven't started yet. This space here. Well, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for inviting me to speak here. Thank you for taking care of this place so well. It looks really bright and up and happy. And also immediately my apologies that I talk again here in front of my elders. But I guess it has to be. And I'm also particularly happy to have my old teacher, Brother David, here, who a lot of you know anyway from old days, and who was with Koban at Tassahara in the early days. Brother David and myself just attended a conference in Madison, and at the end of the conference there was a panel discussion of the speakers, and one person, all open and inspired from a couple or 3 days of interesting dialogues and encouraging, said, you know, to the panel speakers, if we could give them something to take out into the world that they could practice and share with their family and friends. And immediately Brother David came up and very short, he said, I give it to you in two words. Everybody was already listening. He said, fear not. I think we can trace just about every problem we have to fear. That we are, when we are afraid, we shrivel and we get tight and we get tense and we have to protect what we have and worry. Whereas if we can practice generosity, when we, it's one of the paramitas, if we can be, it makes us open, it makes us generous, we share. Instead of competing, we cooperate. You know, we have this, the Austrians, in order to distinguish themselves from the Germans, we say at the same situations we look at, and the German person will say, the situation is serious, but not hopeless. And the Austrians will say, the situation is hopeless, but not serious. And I vacillate between these two positions. And I think both have something to it. I mean, you know, it would be just ignorant to say that the situation isn't serious. So we have to look at things. We cannot just deny the things that are, both in our lives, personal lives, and in the world at large. I mean, they're really serious things. And yes, we can and have to do something about it. If for no other reason than to feel good. If we are confronted with a problem or a difficulty and we don't do anything, it will overwhelm us. Whereas if we can do something, if we can engage in some way, immediately we feel better. It may not help much, but at least we feel better. So that is the one side. And the other is, of course, we have to relax somehow. It's in some ways, in some very fundamental way, the situation is really hopeless anyway. I mean, we all will disappear again, and our individual self will disappear, and the whole world will disappear. Give it a few more billion years and the whole planet will be gone. So so we can relax. It's not so serious. Things go on anyway, and we should not overestimate our human power yet. I mean, even if the worst of worst comes to happen, the planet will go on and life will go on. We are not that powerful yet. And, you know, new things will happen, so we can relax. And as in so many, balance seems to be such an important thing. You know, things are not really good or bad, but at the right time, the right mixture of things seems to make it go. So, when we speak, we should speak from our heart. We should speak about things that really matter to us. So, I would like to share with you, not so different from what I did at that conference a couple of days ago, touch upon three things that are culturally somewhat taboo, or things that at least there's some likelihood to either annoy you or even offend you. This is a very friendly audience, so But like, you know, in that conference there were over 300 people, a lot of them scientists, and from a different world a little bit. So, one of the things I wanted to mention, one of the things that are that keep me busy, that I keep thinking about and that occupy my mind when I look at this world, is which one should I start with? Maybe I start with psychedelics. As some of you know, it was, and in this regard, I'm just a very typical member of that species, that many of us as youngsters had some experiences that changed their life in connection with psychedelics and brought me, when I was 20 or 21, I took some micrograms of LSD, and that completely changed my life. It got me out of a quite well-settled, comfortable and protected life where I thought I knew pretty much what I wanted and where I was going, into difficult, well, both ecstatic and difficult and on my second trip, I experienced myself as a Buddha. Well, that is for somebody who I didn't know anything about Buddha. I knew the sort of Eastern religion, but and I was not particularly religious to start out with. So that was very exciting and very interesting, but also confusing. And that then I became a yogi for 3 years, and then I ended up in Zen practice. But very clearly, without that experience, I don't think I would be sitting here now. Of course, one never knows, but so after becoming a good Zen student at the Zen Center of San Francisco in Tassajara, I basically was completely abstinent for 25 years. Maybe took some green tea, was about as far as I went on drugs. And then I knew I had to go back and look into what had such an important influence on my life. And as some of you know, this interested accumulated for now in a study that we just finished at the Felsentor Center in Switzerland, in cooperation with the University of Zurich, where we conducted a 1 week session. And on the fourth day, half of the people got psilocybin, and half of them got placebo. It was a legal study, and we had 8 or 10 doctors up there and half a clinic set up, and people got into the tube before the MRI and afterwards, and it was a big deal. I was very happy that it was also well set up, but like, you know, shooting on birds with cannons. Last fall I attended in Portugal the Boom Festival, which is sort of the European version of the Burning Man. And well, if you see what's going on there, and then you see a few people taking psilocybin, and you have 10 doctors looking over them and taking blood pressures 4 times during the course. But I was happy anyway that they were well. And all went very well, and the scientific part, I don't know even really, to be frankly, exactly what they're looking at. And it's not, that much I know, that all of those 20 people who were active had good, deep experiences. Some of them very deep, very important. Some of them, those were all experience. So in order to apply for the study, you had to have as long a meditation experience as possible and as little substance experience as possible. So some were totally naive, drug-wise. Some had some experiences. They were among them. It wasn't, you couldn't say the average population. I think about a quarter had PhDs, and there were 3 Zen teachers from different lineages, not from our lineage, and some yoga teachers. They were experienced people. And some were, you know, could sort of was very interesting, but they were quite in control, and you barely would notice anything if you would look from the outside. We would just continue in the regular schedule of a sesshin. 30-minute sitting, 10 minutes kinhin, 30-minute sitting, 10 minutes kinhin. Then the time when lunch came around, of course, they weren't hungry. So then we laid down a little bit. We had a shakuhachi player come and play. Then a little bit later, I played the gong, the big gong. So some of them were could control it quite well. You know, could be able to enter that space and come out again and go in again, depending on. And others were completely blown away. But none of them had, and that's also nice, to had any severe confusion or fear going along with that, which, you know, is one of the things that can happen. When we approach the mystery, there is some trembling going on, some awe, some attraction and beauty, but also some real trembling. We don't know. When we leave the familiar landscape of mental busyness, we always come into new territory. And that's always a little bit unsettling. So this is one of the areas I'm really interested in, and since I have ruined my good reputation as a Zen teacher anyway, so there is some freedom now in and I get quite a few requests in that. So of course it's not legal, I mean, on a regular basis, you have to go through the enormous, it took several years to get that happen, and you know, there's enormous paperwork and ethicomic committees, and I could not have done it anyway. I could only do it because I have a good friend who is a professor at the university and who has been doing, he's a neurologist. He has worked with psilocybin for over 20 years now, so he had all the connections with the institution that give the permission and so forth. But he had never done a group session like that either, so it was quite new for him. It was always done one-to-one in the clinic. So to have it on the mountain up there, which is quite remote, we had to have a clinic up there. You know, if somebody has a heart attack or so, you know, somebody can have a heart attack on the toilet, but if that happens in a setting like that, we would have to make sure to be able to show that it had nothing to do with what we were doing. But all went well. Nobody had a heart attack. And we even have to, probably we will be able to do another one within that. We will try an amendment within that study to give the placebo people a chance to experience it. I mean, they went all through a lot of effort to, you know, several times going to the university clinic first and having physical checkups and psychological checkups and all that. It was very carefully screened. We got 40 people, maybe out of 200 people, So then, you know, that when they found out that they had placebo, I told Franz, the professor, my friend, I said, you know, you're not the group that you compare it, the placebo group. You don't compare psilocybin people with normal people. You compare psilocybin people on psilocybin with highly frustrated people. If you looked at them at the MRI, yeah, MRI and... You know, and if I think at the effect of course, in the 60s and 70s, there was this great wakening up on the planet, or some great enthusiasm, and hundreds of thousands of people were willing to dramatically really change their life, put it in question what we are doing, and we're ready to put their life on the line. And I myself, I was a dropout from university and so forth. So if I look at the world and the speed at which things are going, at least I could imagine that these substances, these very powerful substances, could play a positive role in the development of what's going on. Which brings me to number two of unpopular topics, or not unpopular, it's just controversy.
Taboo use.
Taboo use, yeah, right. Well, the second one is that we are just too many people. You know, when I was born in 1948, we had about 2.2 billion people, and now we have three times as many. In one short lifetime. You know, one lifetime in evolutionary, when we look at the planet from an evolutionary point of view, is nothing. I mean, it's nothing. And we tripled just within. Every day, every single day, there are 200,000 more people on this planet. And it seems like, as a species, we are not aware of it or not willing to look at it. I mean, of course, many people know that, and some even do something or try to do something about it, but as a species, we are not really aware of it. And as long as we multiply like that, it's very important to turn off the lights when we go out and to have more efficient cars, and that's all very important. I do not by any means put that down, but if we keep multiplying like that, it will just completely nullify these efforts. The ecological impact that we have is, I mean, all these people, of course, they have to breathe. They say 10 people breathe about as CO2 relevant as one car. So that's 20,000 new cars every day just right there from breathing. But of course, once they get big, they grow up and have enough, then they want to eat, then they have to be dressed. And of course, they also want a car at some point, if possible, naturally, or an iPhone at least. All very understandable, but in a limited world, we cannot have unlimited growth. I mean, that just doesn't... You know, we are like grasshoppers falling over this planet, or even worse, like a cancerous growth, really, at the expense of all other living forms. There will be no big wild animals on this planet in a few decades. There will be no more wild elephants, giraffes, orangutans, and so forth, because there's just no space. We suck it up. When I come into that kind of, then I have to remember my Austrian heritage. And relax. There are no easy answers to that, as we know. But one thing is for sure, we know that when, you know, women have more saying, if they are better educated and have a better social status, immediately the birth rate drops. About half of all the pregnancies in this world, we figure, are not wanted by women, by the women. So, but you know, how go and raise the status? In the first world, birth rates are no problem anyway. And there they have the status and they have the education already. But I think the first step is necessary that we acknowledge that we have a problem here in this respect. And very closely related to that comes my third unpopular theme, and that is that we have to reduce our intake of animal products. Animal-based products. We have to return to a more plant-based diet. This may seem to be sort of, you know, not so relevant, or I mean, there are a million diets around that people recommend for one reason or another, but I'm personally convinced that there are few things that an individual can do for a better world, and with better I mean a world where there is less suffering and more happiness and joy, is by reducing our intake of animal-based products. It's very hard. I haven't really found a scientific study of that, but researching it a little bit, my estimate would be that certainly over half, but maybe up to 75% of our ecological footprint on this planet is directly related to our eating, to our food production, and which is in some way not so surprising. You know? I mean, we have mobility and we have to build houses and we have to make weapons, it looks like, and lead wars, but still, certainly over half of it can be directly traced down to the to our need to eat, to our feeding, the destruction of the forests and so forth. And among that, and that is scientific, much better researched, is if we would change to a plant diet rather than, you know, if we would eat the grains and the soybeans and all that directly rather than feed it to animals and then eat the animals or the products of the animals, the milk, we would reduce that chunk by 80 to 90%. That's very amazing, but you know, we feed almost half of the grain in the world that we grow to the animals that we can directly consume ourselves. And 95% of the soybeans we feed to the animals. We could directly. Now, it's not a black and white thing, you know, you don't have to be completely. The older I get, the more critical I'm of 100% solutions. They usually cause more problems than they solve. But the direction is very clear. We have to reduce and I just gave Michael a copy of the China study, a book I highly recommend. It's not only that the ecological impact, which is dramatic, really, but also if we believe good science, it really is not healthy for us, contrary to what we were taught, and that it's if you believe science, and that book, The China Study, is a sort of it shows all the studies that have been done. It's the China Study. It's the title is a little bit confusing, but it's just sort of the Rolls Royce of all these studies. It's one study that has been going on for decades with thousands of people in China, mostly organized from America. But in China, you have the advantage of having a very homogeneous base of DNA. They're all Han people, and then you have very different areas. You have people living on the ocean. They eat very differently from the people living in the mountains, and they eat very differently from the people living in the desert kind. It's a big country, so they have different areas, and within that area, the people eat very similar. At the, you know, the people that live on the coast in that village, they're basically all the same. And so they went there and they actually analyzed the food that they're eating to a very clear degree. And then they look what sicknesses do they get and what do they die of, and do that over a long period of time. And then, you know, sometimes a family moves anyway, which is rare, but and they move into another region, and then they can look how does the health of that change when they start taking a different diet. So in a nutshell, if you believe that, it's the less animal proteins we take to us, the healthier we are. It's radical, but that seems to be what... And I'm sure there are exceptions to that, like there are exceptions to everything, and you know, like in the 50s and 60s, science pretty much knew that smoking cigarettes heightens your risk of lung cancer. Well, that wasn't a very popular message. For one thing, there's a strong industry behind that is not interested in dispersing that kind of knowledge. And then, but maybe even more important, the consumers do not want to hear that. I mean, if I'm smoking, I don't want to be told that I, you know, may harm myself. And the same is true for eating. I mean, eating is a very deep habit. It's almost like sex. You cannot talk about it. I mean, it's like eating is very personal. So you don't want to hear that. Especially Campbell, the author of this China study, says most Westerners do not get the benefits. Most Western vegetarians do not get the benefit of the vegetarian diet because they think they have to compensate by taking in more milk products, more yogurts and cheese and milk. And in some ways, that's even more problematic than meat. Meat, we probably in our evolution was always part of our diet, you know, depending on the climate and where we were. We probably were hunters and gatherers, and we couldn't afford to be picky. We had to eat what we could, and that was very often probably a piece of meat. Though if we compare ourselves to our close relatives, the big apes and so forth, they are either total or 95% vegans. You know, they don't. They're not tigers or... And milk we really only consume for the last few thousand years at most, since we had domesticated animals. Before that we didn't have milk. Of course not. Where would we get it from? I mean, we had milk as babies, and all out of the about 4,500 mammals that crawl and hop around this planet, we are the only one who, for beyond being a small baby, think that we have to need milk. Milk is a very highly specialized food that stands for quick growth, physical growth. You know, we are small and we have to grow quickly. And then once we have done that, we do not, our mother doesn't let us on the breast anymore. We have to eat other things. So many of the sicknesses are closely associated with this milk drinking. You know, of course, they try to tell us that we need it, like osteoporosis or so. Well, osteoporosis is basically unknown in those countries where they don't drink milk, like in Japan, and is rampant in the countries where we drink most, like in America and Middle and Northern Europe. And of course, last but not least, you know, and that's not directly, we could eat milk and meat without torturing the animals, but fact is, 95% of the meat and the milk that we consume today is produced in a way that is totally unacceptable, you know, by in factory farm situations where we really torture these animals. So I've said all the unpleasant things that I had to say, and I'm very sorry. Actually, at the conference, I had a fourth one to add spontaneously, because one of the speakers just before me was a brilliant scientist, obviously brain scientist, with very interesting and very helpful and far out ideas and things he works on. But a lot of it he does with works on mice, you know, with animal experimentation. So I had to put the question out there. I said, I mean, how do we hope to create a better, saner world, a more harmonious world, by torturing other creatures? And then I got them a good laugh out. I said, you know, it's reminds me of the saying when we were hippies, we were, you know, anti-war, and we had that saying, fighting for peace is like fucking for virginity. to torture other beings and thinking we can somehow, with the knowledge we gain through that, have a saner world is just doesn't make sense. Well, in this circle, we all fairly safe. Most of us are beyond the stage where we will produce many children. And most of us here, I guess, are not really shocked at the idea that maybe psychedelics are not all evil and maybe even helpful. I think most of us also are, you know, compared to the general population, are much more on the vegetable side than on the meat. And so, maybe I will conclude here, and maybe just to give you another little image that I found helpful, and then we can open a little bit. Maybe you have something to say or want to ask something. But there's this story that I think she's an Italian biologist or so, describes what happens when a caterpillar, You know, caterpillars are these creatures that really are eating a lot. That's all they do, basically. They grow very fast. And then at some point, they cocoon themselves. They put themselves into a cocoon. And then she describes what goes on in there. There's the caterpillar. For the caterpillar is in some way total catastrophe. It disintegrates. It disintegrates. It's not that the eye of the caterpillar becomes the eye of the butterfly, but it goes, dissolves itself in some kind of a soup of cells. And of course, the caterpillar is highly alarmed and tries to fight it. And is, even though it's a self-made situation, very similar to us humans on this planet. And then, at various points, and we don't have no idea how it happens, these cells start to organize themselves in a new way. And out of that, at some point, comes a butterfly. So I think there's hope for us. And regardless of what we see, I mean, obviously the universe has a higher intelligence than we have, and I think we can trust that have hope that, thanks God, it doesn't depend on us in which direction the universe should go, but doesn't mean that we shouldn't. I mean, we have to take care as good as we can of the world and as good as we understand it. But I think we also, can remember our Austrian heritage and know that it's not too serious, no matter what. So, I don't know, maybe some of you want to say something or to want to know something more.
Or just that, you said no fear there at the beginning, and every one of those scenarios, I can plug into fear inside of me. Like, I've seen fear in the psychedelic realms, and I have fear about global warming, and I have fear about health, whatever, not so much fear about that. But so what do you do, like, when you get caught in the fear? And I know you said relax, that, it's a bigger picture, and I get that, but sometimes, in my day-to-day life, I get caught in that fear, and I can run with it for a while. And I know it's like, come back to the breath. But I don't know if you have any tricks or points or ideas of things to try when the fear has a hold of me. Because I want to run up to people and go, don't you realize the elephants are going to disappear? I get so, and then I turn people off because I'm too intense, So guidance on that would be great.
As most things, it starts with realizing or recognizing or being aware of. When we are fearful and driven, and we are so driven that we don't realize that we are just driven. And that's, so in the minute you realize that, there's already some of the iron grip is loosening, When you remind yourself that here I am getting into that kind of tense state of being afraid or being upset. It doesn't change immediately, but it does loosen up something. It does loosen. And then you can, you're an experienced person. The minute you realize that and you feel that, it manifests in your body. So you can also work on your body to relax your mind, as we do in yoga, So you relax your shoulders and you take a good breath. And you maybe, if you have a chance, you look at the beautiful flower and the sun and so forth. So that's what we do in meditation. We come again and again, let go of whatever it is, and try to find how we cultivate our calmness, that we sort of an island that we have that we can return to. The more familiar with it we are with it, and we create little spaces during the day where we bring ourselves back, you know, like telephone meditation. When the telephone rings, you don't just pick it up, you let it ring a couple of times and you take a breath. You come to yourself and then you pick up the telephone. There are innumerable little sort of stopping points that we try to install in our day. One of the the older you get, the more succinct you bring your things together. So one of the things Brother David teaches now is stop, look, go. Like children when they go across the street, you know. You have to somehow find a way to, again and again, stop in the middle of the busyness that we are. And then look, what's happening right now. Feel, how do I feel right now? And then it becomes clear what the next step is. And that's the important part, actually, the step. We have to get moving. You have to do something. So, yeah. And it usually helps when we see ourselves in a bigger context. You know, if we're just this one little person, it's so frustrating and scary and hopeless. But the minute we are all bodhisattvas and Avalokiteshvara's thousand arms. You know, we are all manifestations of this great idea of compassion, of serving this world, of helping ease the suffering. The Avalokiteshvara is hearing of the suffering of this world and acting and doing something. And there can be many, you know, small, it's all small steps. But in the minute I feel that and I see I can relax. And I can be more helpful to people, actually. But I think your comment or question, I think each one of us completely can share with you that feeling.
I want to say that I've gotten really interested in fear in recent years. I think for whatever reason I feel more of it than I did. And so that helps me just like to see, okay, what is this thing kind of apart from what might be causing it or all the different reasons, which of course there's always like a million reasons to be terrified. You know. I was terrified to come here. People got my email. How am I going to get from the airport to Jakarta? I hate traveling. But one thing I noticed with me anyway is that, like, the feeling fear doesn't go away, you know, when I want it to, let's put it that way. Sometimes it's just there. And it kind of reminds me of, like, when you're sitting sashin and you have this, well, either like enormous sleepiness or, you know, enormous pain. And of course, you know, we're kind of encouraged not to do anything, you know, just keep sitting. And I remember one time I realized that sleep was so much bigger than me. It was just like this huge being, you know, and I could like try to drive it away and breathe differently or, you know, whatever, all the things that we do. But when I realized that I saw sleep that way as something that's just so much bigger than me, you know, it really helped me sort of, like I never like had really problems with sleep after that. I mean, not that I didn't get sleepy and stuff, but so that's sort of, I'm kind of thinking of fear that way. It's, you know, like fear is just bigger than me. You know, and of course it's great to do things that I can because it's so unpleasant and anything we can do to relieve our own suffering is a good thing. But at this point anyway, I'm just kind of interested in fear because, you know, I see how, you know, we went into a horrible war because we were terrified, you know, 2000 whatever, 2 or something like that. And I mean, as a country, we were terrified. And so I think it's really a worthy thing to try to understand.
Hi, Carolyn. Hi, Alan. Well, just in time for the closing gatha, I guess. the ending of one thing is the beginning of the next thing. So.
I just want to put in a plug for Jokoji's podcast site. If you look at last week's talk, I think it was on fear.
Huh.
This talk will also be posted on the site.
Ooh.
Okay. Came out this week called Zigzag Zen, Zen and Psychedelics. Uh-huh. If anyone's interested in that topic, I actually have a piece of it as well. It has Ram Dass and John Halifax. It's a wonderful compendium for people who might be interested in what I'm talking about.
Now that you mention it, the publisher asked me also to write something, and I just didn't get around to do it.
Not too late.
Yeah,
looking for bloggers.
Yeah, yeah, and there will be, you know, another edition, and there is always a chance. Another one will arise. That's one of the nice things about our lives, is really that every time we miss a chance, there's the next one.
Thank you for the talk. I feel like I used to be much more cynical about the world, and it's actually in working with young people that I became much more hopeful. I work with a program that takes American high school and gap year students to remote areas of the developing world, and so that the young people can connect one with another, learn about each other's cultures, and in that time transform themselves as well through nature, through understanding the group, understanding each other. And it just strikes me how resourceful young people are and how much more service-minded they are when I was their age. Mm. I really do feel over the years that the consciousness is shifting. Mm. And, you know, so they I feel much more inspired by them, that they can solve the problems that my generation and the previous generations created, because you have to change your consciousness in order to solve a systematic problem. And I'm curious as to your thought about consciousness itself, self-reflecting consciousness itself changing, evolving. Holly was describing a young person who caught a hummingbird with her hands out of the air. You know, that's like a superpower. And so I feel like the children have capacities that we don't.
Absolutely. And I also have great trust in the collective wisdom that we have. You know, it's not individual that are so important, I think. We have to rediscover our collective wisdom or collective consciousness, our swarm consciousness, maybe, you know, you know, the insects are some of the most successful life forms on this planet, much older than we are, and they are, most of them are organized in a collective way. I mean, I'm a beekeeper, and, you know, there's no question that any individual bee is immediately ready to sting you and kill herself by do it if she thinks you threaten the hive, you know. They're not aggressive if you leave them alone, and ants the same thing, you know. There's no question they put the good of the whole above their individual, and we of course have turned it around. So I think we have to again Well, but it's not nothing new. It's the Bodhisattva ideal, really, that we recognize that our own well-being, the whole is served best if we put our own well-being a little bit below the common good. So I think we're all on a good path. And thank you very much. And I'm also happy to report that now, like at Felsentor, we just in the last year, we have quite a few young people showing up, between 20 and 30, I mean, age group. And there are always several of them up there, and I find that is also encouraging, that it's not, we are not just this kind of all the dinosaurs dying out, leftovers from the 60s and 70 culture. I'm looking forward to a nice day with you and have lunch, and thank you very much.
May our intention equally bend to every being and place, with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma deeds are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.